Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org.
Support for WPR comes from the American Society of Landscape Architects Wisconsin chapter, dedicated to reimagining the design of outdoor spaces for the well-being of all. Examples at wiasla.com.
This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, and maybe with you if you have a question for Zorba. Here's our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Through the hour, Zorba talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Zorba always brings along some really interesting research. What have we this time, Zorba?
We're going to talk about surgery, new techniques that are on the horizon that may be even less invasive than the scope techniques that are commonly used for appendicitis and gallbladder surgery and so on. Some exciting new data.
I've looked at this, taking the appendix out through your mouth.
Through your mouth. Sounds exciting.
That sounds exciting. What else?
And new hip treatments, a way of resurfacing the hip instead of replacing the hip. Where does that fit in? Certainly baby boomers 60 and over who often need knee replacements or hip replacements. What do you do with this new resurfacing technique and where is it going?
And a yummy dessert for
it is berry tortilla pizza. So listen, it's berry, which is dessert. It's tortilla, which is Hispanic, and it's pizza, which is Italian. How can you go wrong? And it's sweet.
And we have a medical myth buster coming up, too. Lots of reasons for you to stay tuned, and maybe you'll want to call Zorba at 800-462-7413. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
No, we appreciate it. How can we help you?
I have a question regarding gallbladder.
Mm-hmm.
I had a gallbladder attack back in 2003. They did some tests, and it was only functioning at about 10% of normal. A surgeon recommended removal, but I didn't agree. I wanted to try diet modification, and that has worked for me so far. I have not had any other problems, and I'm wondering, am I risking my health having this non-functioning organ in my body?
Well, what kind of symptoms were you having?
Oh, just this horrible, excruciating pain.
Mm-hmm. And they also, did they find gallstones at all?
No, they did an ultrasound and said they could not see any gallstones.
Okay. First of all, you are doing yourself absolutely no harm on waiting for something like this. In other words, you're not doing yourself any harm, but let's kind of look at what the issues are.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, gallstones, and you don't have them, are very, very common. And the present recommendations are if you have gallstones and you have no symptoms, there's no reason to remove the gallbladder. In other words, we find them quite often in a secondary way. So gallstones with normal gallbladder functioning, forget it. You don't need surgery. Now, sometimes what we find is that people have a sludge. You know, you can just picture what sludge is, sort of a thick, Tom is just making a disgusting look with his face, sort of thicker material in the gallbladder, or the gallbladder doesn't seem to contract as much as it usually does. That accompanied by symptoms such as abdominal pain and discomfort, then we say, well, we take out the gallbladder and life is good because you don't have the pain. But it's not as if it necessarily leads to complications. In other words, it's a function of your symptoms. Gallbladder problems are problems with people in our society who eat more fat, more refined sugars, and so on. It's really not something that we find, for instance, in developing countries. It's something that we find basically in postmodern, industrial, service-oriented economies where we have lots of food and lots of fat. Mm-hmm. So if you're doing it by diet, that's great. What are you doing by diet?
Well, I determined that it was spicy foods. I was the kind of person that would like to eat super hot peppers. And I cut that out and have not had any further problems.
So
I don't,
it wasn't fat. It wasn't a fat issue.
Well, I don't eat a lot. I'm a vegetarian. I don't eat a lot of fatty meats or things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is good. By the way, the gallbladder is a storage house. It only stores bile. The bile is produced in the liver. Bile is necessary for emulsification of fat so our body can digest it better. And we don't need it. It's a store place. We can get by without it. And that's why removing it doesn't usually affect life in anybody.
Did I hear you right? You're a vegetarian, and now you have to cut out spicy food?
Well, hot peppers. I would like to make these stir fries with these super hot peppers and rice and tomatoes.
That's got to be a boring existence.
Yeah, boring. You mean now
a vegetarian without any spice?
No, no, just really hot stuff.
Oh, really? So in other words, a little hot is okay, but really hot is not good for your stomach. So now, how long have you been doing? You've been doing this then for a few years, and you've been fine. No problem.
Yeah, almost since 2003.
No problem. You are not doing yourself harm, and in fact, you're basically treating your gallbladder disease in a natural way. Continue with it, and you may be just fine forever.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Appreciate the call. Thanks a lot for calling 800-462-7413. An appropriate time, I think, Zorba, to work on that research that you mentioned about taking the appendix out through your mouth.
Through your mouth. Very interesting type research. First of all, let's look back at the use of scopes. These scopes are called fiber optic scopes, and they can bend, turn around corners because basically they're not straight line scopes. We've had fiber optics for years, and they're very, very useful because you can look down in a stomach, you can look up and have a colonoscopy, and they have been used now. The scopes of various sorts have now been used to look into knees, to take out gallbladders through the belly. You know, you make a little incision, to do appendixes through the belly, to do hernias through the belly. And we've discovered that the postoperative complication rates and the postoperative pain of going through the stomach, the outside of the stomach, the outside of the belly, if you will, with the scopes is great. Well, this is another technique that someone is pioneering in Ohio. And the technique is where you go down, instead of going through the outside of the stomach, you go down through the stomach inside. So you swallow this tube. Obviously, you're asleep.
Right.
They go into the stomach, make a little incision in the stomach, and then look out with this tube.
From the inside out.
From the inside, go find the appendix, scoop it out, take it out with this basic tube that goes around, and then go back to the stomach, sew it up, and come out the other way. So it sounds great. But the issue is, what is the complication rate? Because the stomach itself has may have contents in it, may have bacteria in it because we've swallowed food and so on, and that has yet to be seen. In other words, you've opened up the gut in another spot, and then what are the complications from that? So I think it's very exciting. You know, it's sort of science fiction science, but to be able to take out the appendix without any incision in the belly is obviously going to hurt less. The question is, what is the complication?
So if I did this this way, I could still be a model if I wanted.
You could still be a model. Exactly. That's right. You could still be a model.
No scar on
you
me
can have
anywhere.
All of those scars. But the other method that's kind of interesting that is now part of this is then going down all the way with this tube through the intestine to where the appendix is and then doing it around there, making a little incision, taking the appendix out, and then pulling back in. And you can just imagine, you know, using these scopes to do it. But scopes have made a revolution. Revolution in surgery that occurred about a decade ago. They decreased pain and discomfort and complication rates, and they're awesome, and this may be a new method.
Pretty interesting.
Very.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. A listener now, Zorba, in Ewing, New Jersey. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. What's up?
Well, I've been having for the last 2 months a series of really chronic headaches kind of all the time. Wake up in the morning, my head hurts, take an Excedrin, drive to school. By the time I'm at school, I've got another headache. I need another Excedrin. And this continues throughout the day. And I've seen a couple of doctors, and so far I haven't had any advice that's been able to help me. I've heard that it's a pinched nerve in my neck. I've heard that it's stress. I heard that I need to take caffeine out of my diet, but I don't drink coffee or a soda. So I haven't had anything that really helped me.
It's hard to take caffeine out of your diet when you have no caffeine.
Yeah, right.
I will agree with that. There's no doubt about it. Well, first of all, headaches are really, really tough. I mean, headaches are not simple. We have migraine headaches, and then we have everything else. And we call them muscle contraction headaches and tension headaches and headaches that can come with allergies and so on. These have gone on for how long?
About 2 months.
2 months. Okay. Before that, were you a headache person?
I would get a headache occasionally, like a very bad headache that, you know, required me to sit down.
Mm-hmm.
But never this sort of continuous, you know, nonstop aching.
Uh-huh. And you're taking, nothing seems to be working, nothing that's over the counter?
No. I've been taking a lot of Excedrin.
Mm-hmm. And what has the Excedrin done?
The Excedrin will knock it out for maybe an hour or 2 hours, and then I have to take another one.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't do much. In other words, it's a minimal thing. Okay, how many doctors have you seen?
I've seen 2 doctors.
Mm-hmm. Family physicians, internists, neurologists?
The physicians at our regular clinic.
Okay. You need to get a full evaluation from someone who specializes in headaches. That's what you need. Now, neurologists often treat headaches, but sometimes there are headache clinics. There are a number of family physicians who also treat headaches and internists who do a lot of headache treatment, because you need to get a diary and an evaluation. Neurologically, usually when we examine people with headaches, we don't find anything that's wrong. However, you need to have a good half-hour interview to find out if there's a migraine component, an allergy component, a food allergy component, which is completely separate, a stress component, a muscle contraction component, or a pinched nerve component. There are lots of different components. A lot of people have mixed headaches. They don't have one thing, they have 2 things or 3 things. You need to find out what the triggers are, and then ultimately you need to be tested on certain medications to see what will help it. You may have low-level migraine headaches. We don't have time to look, you know, discuss it on the air because it takes 10 minutes or 15 minutes of an interview to see that, in which case beta blockers will help, or anti-epileptic drugs will help, such as Topamax. So, but that's what you need. You've got to get an evaluation. It's a tough issue. So I do have one recommendation, though. Have you taken any over-the-counter Aleve or ibuprofen?
I usually take Aleve for muscle aches.
Okay. While you're waiting to get that appointment, I have 2 recommendations. Get Aleve, generic Aleve, just as good as the name brand, 2 Aleve tablets twice a day and 1 aspirin tablet a day, 1 full-strength aspirin tablet a day, every single day.
Okay.
And the reason is, for some people, that immediately knocks away their headaches.
Really?
I mean, it's just a common thing for a pinched nerve and a muscle contraction headache, long-acting anti-inflammatory,
take
such as naproxen, which is Aleve. Mm-hmm. 2 Aleve and an aspirin in the morning, and then 2 Aleve in the evening before I go to sleep. Mm-hmm. And that may get rid of your headache. And if that's the case, then call us up, donate to public radio, and cancel the appointment with your doctor. Thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, good luck to you.
Thanks.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. To a listener now, Zorba, in Rolla, Missouri. Hi.
Hi. Hello. How are you?
Fine.
Good.
How can we help you?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I guess the beginning of this month, I started having a really bad cold, and that went into laryngitis for like 4 days, and then I went to my doctor, and he said I had an ear infection, more common in 3-year-olds. He gave me a sulfa drug, and the result is I have tinnitus now. I guess my question right now is I'm having a really hard time sleeping, and I know it's louder at night, but in my case, if I lay down, it's really hard. I mean, I am using a white noise machine. The other question I had is I also read that I'm not supposed to have any my little half glass of red wine with dinner during this situation.
Why? Why can't you have the red wine?
Well, I thought I read that I wasn't supposed to have stimulants, caffeine, and I'm staying away from that. And
uh-huh.
then I read somewhere
yeah.
that I shouldn't have red wine either.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, if you read enough, what will happen is you'll stop eating and drinking everything and having a good time. We live in such a puritanical society.
No,
you know,
I have
the
my
first
wine
thing
with
we
dinner.
Do, you know, when we have problems is let's take away the coffee, no red wine, no sex, no joy, no happiness, and you might as well be in the stocks, you know. And then
uh-huh.
if you're in the stocks, in the stockade at night, then you'll be fine. You know, it's. I always find it very interesting that when you go to websites, they don't say, go out and have a good time and enjoy yourself and then have the tinnitus at night. You know, if you stay out late and party every night and you're really sleep deprived, you won't have any trouble with the tinnitus when you go to sleep because you'll be sleep deprived. But you never see that on websites. It's always take away the good stuff. Take away the good stuff. Well, tinnitus is basically from injury that occurs in the ear.
Uh-huh.
And it often occurs over age. We all have it when we're young and we have colds and sore throats and our ears get plugged, we'll get tinnitus. I remember calling it a loud noise when I was a kid, and that's basically what it is in the ear.
Mm-hmm.
And we notice it when we're going to sleep at night.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people notice it during the day, but it's when things are quiet. So you bought a white noise machine, you mean, or you turn on the radio for white noise?
I bought a white noise machine.
Mm-hmm. How do you like it?
It's okay. It doesn't really mask the sound, especially when I lay down.
Yeah. Well, first of all, if it's only going on for 3 or 4 weeks, the chances are very, very likely this is going to go away. Permanent injury is a white noise that tends to be there. 3.5 weeks easily, you're well within a healing period of what's going to happen. So first of all, have faith that this is going to get better. I think if you have a glass of red wine with dinner, that's fine. I don't think that's going to affect it at all. And also, I don't think there's any good evidence that caffeine affects tinnitus at all.
I don't really drink a lot of caffeine anyway. Oh. Mainly it's my problem. Why is it worse when I lay down rather than sit up at night?
Mm-hmm. Well, because it is. That's just the way it is, because it is. I don't have an explanation. No, this is probably going to go away. Hang in there, whatever makes you comfortable to go to sleep. I certainly think you can have your glass of red wine and maybe a little brie cheese. You could even have dessert. You could even watch any kind of, anything on TV you want to watch at night before you go to sleep. But you're going to have it's going to be a little more difficult for a while.
So it might go away or even lessen?
Oh, I don't think it's permanent. 3.5 weeks, started with an ear infection, chances of being permanent, minimal.
Okay. Well, thank you very much,
Sherba.
You're
welcome.
Thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. At 800-462-7413. I had tinnitus or tinnitus, whichever, for like 2 or 3 years, and it went away.
Right. That's exactly it. And it can go away. Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, our brain adjusts to it. It does go away, but also there's an adjustment in our brain. And I'll give you a good example. If you are out on the street and there's a lot of street noise, you can block it out when you're talking to somebody and hear them when you're looking at them. But if you're out on the street and you close your eyes, let's say you're resting on a park bench, you'll notice, for instance, that there's a lot of noise there and you can't sleep. So it's what our brain attends to. And your brain may have knocked it out knowing that it doesn't have to attend to that information that's going on.
My brain has a difficult time adjusting to anything.
Tom, holder of the non-adjustable brain. I love it. I love it.
A listener joins in now, Zorba, in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hello.
Thanks
for having me on the show.
Sure. How can we help?
I've had an issue with, I guess, an arthritic condition is what I call it, for the past year now. I was in the military and the Navy up until about 6 months ago, and the doctors there were unable to give any positive answers as to what my situation was. I guess what it is, I've woken up and my joints, especially in my hands and my knees, would really hurt when I wake up. And even, say midday, I wouldn't be able to squat down. And, there's a lot of different physical things you have to do in the military. So that sometimes became an issue.
Wow. How old are you?
24.
Uh-huh.
So you were having pain in your joints when you squatted down. And what did the military doctors say?
Well, they said it's definitely not arthritis, was the best thing they could tell me.
Okay.
But that was about it.
So tell me about your discomfort. When it bothers you when you squat down?
I haven't really noticed as much with my knees, but like I said, my hands and my knees are very sore when I wake up, as if I'd been working out the day before, something like that.
Well, how long does it take for that to go away?
It goes away to an extent, within an hour, but I mean, I've lost about 50% of the strength of my hands, I would say.
Oh, that's a big deal.
To be able to grip things and things like that.
My arms and all that are fine. Yeah, but that's a big deal when you're 24. I mean, when you're any age, we lose 50%. What sort of work do you do?
I'm actually a salesperson, so.
Are you working out? What happened in the military, obviously, you do lots of physical labor and workout. I mean, is that grip strength because you can't work out? Or
no, he was in the Navy.
In the
Navy. You don't do any physical work when you're in the Navy.
On and off, depending on whether they want us.
Tom's a Navy man, so he's obviously.
I spent 4 years in the Navy. I can't remember ever doing anything physical.
Yes, that's because your memory.
That I'd be willing to talk about on the radio.
That's what I'm talking about. Selective Navy memory. We don't do any work. What do you remember about the Navy? Well, I've got a couple suggestions. First of all, we need to figure out what this is about. So you got to get the records from your Navy doc. That's what you've got to do, and you can do that through another doctor that you see. It sounds like they did some tests to see if you had rheumatoid arthritis, which is a form of arthritis. You might still have it. They might have not done all of the tests that were necessary for that. that. But at your age, if you've lost 50% of your grip strength and you notice that your joints are not as supple and as mobile as they were before, you need to either see your family doc, internist, or a rheumatologist to see what it is. And if you don't have anyone to see, I would recommend you see a rheumatologist. That is an arthritis specialist to see exactly what's going on, because you've got to get to the bottom of it. There are about 50 or 100 different things that this could be, but at 24, you should not have a drop in grip strength, and you shouldn't have all your other symptoms. So you need a diagnosis. Now, it sounds like they did not do a complete workup in the military. It sounds like they did a partial workup, and you had some abnormality. That doesn't mean it's anything, because we've got lots of tests that are, well, maybe there's something there, or maybe there's something isn't there. That's one of the tests you probably had. But on the other hand, you don't have the records. You don't know what it is. You need a doc to look at that. So I would recommend you take some over-the-counter ibuprofen. And the reason is, why don't you see if you can treat this with over-the-counter medications while you're waiting to see that doc. And I'd recommend 3 600-milligram ibuprofens 3 times a day. Or rather, 3 200-milligram ibuprofens, and that will equal 600 milligrams 3 times a day. That's what I would recommend doing. And I would do that for a month, in the morning, when you come home from work, in the evening, 3 tablets, 3 times a day. Give it 1 month. See what happens. Because that's an anti-inflammatory dose, and you can see what this does. Very, very useful when you go and see that rheumatologist for something such as this.
Or re-up and go see that same guy and say, what did you mean by that? Very interesting stuff.
Re-up. There you go.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Good luck.
Lots more coming up here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. We have our recipe for berry tortilla pizza.
It is dessert.
Zorba and I will actually be tasting this recipe. You, on the other hand,
will not.
You'll have to send for it. We have our medical myth buster, too, and some more research. Lots more of your calls. Lots of reasons to stay with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our number again, 800-462-7413. But we can tell, those of us right here, by the pizza that's sitting next to us, that it's recipe time.
Those of us means you and I at this particular time.
And the production crew on the other side of the glass, they're licking their chops, but they don't get any.
They don't get any.
Adam actually put it together.
It's amazing. This is berry tortilla pizza. Now, pizza, regular pizza, obviously when it comes out of the oven, you can smell it. What's very interesting is this has a smell too. I can smell the berries on the pizza.
Oh, sure.
It smells fresh.
Yeah.
It gives me kind of a warm, cozy feeling, and this is not right next to me. It's very, very interesting that this particular dish can have a smell to it that makes it taste delicious.
Yeah, well, let's do it here.
It's wonderful. Okay, berry tortilla pizza. Real issue is, what do you serve for dessert? What do you do for dessert at your house? Well, often desserts in America are fat-laden, they're too large, they're too many calories. Mm-hmm. That's not the way they were really made for. I mean, dessert in America is often a 400 to 500-calorie meal or half a meal. When you want a dessert, you want to pick a dessert that is filled with flavonoids or carotenoids, vitamins or minerals. You'd like it to have some health component to it in addition to making you happy.
Yeah,
because
like this one.
Yeah, like this one. Okay. Now I'm going to start out with a half cup of whipped cream cheese.
Half a cup of whipped cream cheese.
Okay. Now, cream cheese, for instance, has half the calories in volume than butter. You're not going to use butter in something like this. And I mention it because when you put cream cheese on a bagel, you are cutting your calories in half versus putting butter on a bagel. So cream cheese is great. And if you want to, you can get low-fat and no-fat cream cheese, and you could use a cream cheese called Nufkastel, I can never pronounce it, which has basically half the calories. But we're going to use regular cream cheese because that's the best taste.
Okay.
1 tablespoon of confectioner's sugar.
A big tea, confectioner's sugar.
A pint of fresh blueberries.
A pint of fresh blueberries.
Now, that's the expense. Blueberries are expensive. They are not cheap. And obviously, it's more of a seasonal dish, although we can get blueberries, you know, 24-7 all year round, but they're going to be more expensive in the middle of the winter. But you can't use frozen blueberries. It will not taste good.
Right.
A half cup of sliced strawberries.
Half a cup of sliced strawberries.
One flour tortilla, 10-inch flour tortilla.
Mm-hmm. A large flour tortilla.
A tablespoonful of melted butter.
Big T. Melted butter.
Okay, now, Tom, when you have your bread in the morning, you have toast or something, do you like butter or margarine on it?
Butter.
That's right. I like butter, too. Yeah. Now, I think butter really does taste better. For years, I thought, well, I can't tell the difference between butter and margarine. And then I decided that I was lying to myself, and I really could tell the difference between butter and margarine, and butter is much better. Yeah. Don't go to margarine for it. It's not very much. And 2 teaspoons of cinnamon sugar.
2 little tea cinnamon sugar.
Now, that's right. You can buy cinnamon sugar. You can make cinnamon sugar. Go to the web. And you can find little recipes. It's basically a little bit of cinnamon and a lot of sugar. It's cinnamon-flavored sugar.
Yeah.
Okay, in a small bowl, first of all, preheat that broiler, and, you know, for a few minutes. In a small bowl, combine the cheese and confectioner's sugar.
So these berries are falling off of my thing.
Well, that's okay. You'll get them in your mouth as soon as you can. Yeah, and Tom is going to eat, so just enjoy his crunching. Then, in another small bowl, combine the blueberries and strawberries. Then arrange the tortilla on a broiler pan. It is delicious, isn't it? And brush it with butter and sprinkle and sprinkle it with cinnamon sugar. So you're going to butter the top of that tortilla and you're going to sprinkle it with some wonderful cinnamon sugar. Okay. Now, broil it about 6 inches away from the heat source until lightly brown. That's going to be about 3 minutes. Cool it slightly. Then spread the cheese mixture on top. So you've got butter on the bottom. Mm-hmm. You've got the cheese mixture, which is that sweetened cheese mixture, cream cheese mixture on top. And then top it with the berry mixture. How does it taste?
It's delicious.
You can't even talk.
You've had it, of course, but see how Adam did with it.
I am going to Adam is becoming a wonderful, wonderful chef. You know, before he got this, you know, we've decided, as you said, just before this, Adam is going to have a cooking show with 5 minutes of health in between. And you and I are going to be out of a
job, you were going to say.
Forget the rest of the show. We're just going to eat and shut off the rest of the show. This is a wonderful recipe. If you want this recipe, you can get this at our website. That's zorbapastor.org. It's a great recipe. You can also go down there and sign up for our weekly podcast because we podcast our recipe. And you can look back on past recipes. Come to our website. It's a dynamite place to look.
Or we're happy to send the recipe to you. Just address your request to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, zip code 53706. When you write, though, be sure to enclose a self-addressed stamped business-sized envelope. We're happy to send the recipe along to you. Our phone number is 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is in West Lafayette, Indiana. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I have a question. Mm-hmm. I am a vegan, and I exercise quite a bit, so I try to make sure I always get enough protein in my diet. My sister is a food scientist, and she told me that for non-animal proteins like soy and legumes and grains, they're missing certain amino acids. And so you have to combine them and eat them at the same time in order for your body to be able to use that protein. And I wanted to know if that was bunk.
Is it bunk or not bunk? It's been a hot debate along the line. A book called Diet for a Small Planet, which was a book about 30 years ago. Have you heard of it at all?
Yes, I have, actually. That's what she referred me to.
It's a wonderful book written 30 years ago where she had this idea, and I'm blocking on what her name is, but she really became a great lecturer, wrote a number of other books, that you need to have proteins eaten at the same time. There's something called incomplete amino acids. We need a certain number of amino acids that we don't manufacture ourselves. And animal protein has all of those amino acids, and vegetable proteins do not. They have some of the amino acids. So she looked at certain foods that are traditional foods, such as rice and beans. And when you eat rice and beans together, basically you're combining the amino acids of the rice, the amino acids of the beans at the same meal. and then you're getting the amino acids that you need. I don't think there's any clear evidence that you really have to combine these amino acids together at the same time, eat them at the same time, to get the value of that. There are a lot of countries where vegetarianism is common. Take India, for instance, where there's a huge portion of the population that is vegetarian, and they don't sit around thinking, I have to eat this with that and that with this in order to stay healthy. They just eat a variety of vegetarian dishes. Now, if you look back at the variety of foods that they eat, the most common foods they eat tend to be dishes where you have matched amino acids, such as rice and beans. They don't eat rice and beans, but if you look at their traditional foods of chapati and so on, with the vegetables that they eat, they tend to be the incomplete amino acids. And when you analyze the whole meal, they tend to eat all of the amino acids at that time. But I don't think you have to worry about that and think about it. It certainly is an interesting way of looking at how to balance your diet. I read that book years ago. It changed my life because I thought she had some wonderful ideas on vegetarianism. And there are a lot of vegans especially, and they're much, it's much more problematic for a vegan than a vegetarian, because a vegetarian will eat some animal protein from eggs and milk and cheese. Mm-hmm. And a vegan, of course, has to get all of their protein from veggies. And they have to be even more careful about making sure they eat those varieties of foods. So are you a vegetarian at all?
I used to be a vegetarian. I became a vegan a few years ago.
So, as a vegan, you eat a variety. I mean, you don't just eat the same foods day in and day out, right?
No.
That's really the issue. If you look at Seiji Ozawa, who had a macrobiotic diet, very popular a number of years ago, that diet was such a strict vegan-type diet that it was deficient in vitamin C, and there were outbreaks of scurvy in California on people who followed this diet because the diet was so limiting in terms of fruits, for instance. Mm-hmm. So as a vegan, it's the variety that counts. And it's not eating the amino acids at the same time that I think that are essential.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. A pleasure.
Now, Diet for Small Planet, a very famous book years ago. You can't remember the name of the author. Why didn't you ask me?
Tom, what's the name? Oh, you know the name of the author? What's her name?
Of course I don't know the name of the author. Why would I know the name of the author?
I thought you named it then.
A vegetarian cookbook.
Boy, I fell right into that one, didn't I?
800-462.
Thank you, Tom.
1-800-462-7413. See if we can help a listener now, Zorba, in Bayside, California. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Oh, we appreciate the call. How can we help?
Well, the reason I'm calling is I've had a change in my blood pressure recently. It's gone up to typically 130 to 135 over the low 80s. And I'm 59 years old, and I've always had really good blood pressure. It's almost always been 110 over 68. And this change has occurred rather dramatically in the last 6 months. And I have no idea why. I haven't changed my lifestyle at all.
Well, let me tell you about high blood pressure. High blood pressure appears suddenly without cause and without reason. That's exactly how it occurs, which is why when you go into a doctor's office, your blood pressure is always taken. In other words, that's exactly the reason that it's done. It's just part of the aging process. Now, the issue is that when do we need to treat high blood pressure? And it was a group called the JNC8, which is up to Joint National Committee on the Treatment of Hypertension, has looked at all the data over the years and decided that high normal is when the systolic blood pressure is 136 to 139. Once it's 140, it becomes high blood pressure. And when the diastolic is 86 to 89, once it becomes 90, it's high blood pressure. Now, the reason is this. They've discovered that even the treatment of high normal high blood pressure, if it's consistently there, reduces the risk of heart attack and stroke. Mm-hmm. The initial treatment is lifestyle changes. What's your height? What's your weight?
I'm 6 feet and I weigh 165 pounds.
Okay, so you're the right height, right weight. I mean, you don't have to lose weight. If you were 6 feet and you weighed 260 pounds, I would say lose 10 pounds.
Right.
How much alcohol do you drink?
Probably about 1 to 2 glasses of wine a day,
okay.
Usually with dinner.
Okay. First thing I would do is I'd cut it down to 1 glass and see what happens.
Okay.
It may be age and alcohol related. Reduction in alcohol to 1 glass a day of wine may do it, so it might be that. Do you look at your salt intake? What sort of foods? Do you prepackaged foods and fast foods?
No.
Okay.
I Within reason, I eat about as healthy as I could.
Okay, within reason is good. I'm not for the Puritan diet. I'm against Puritans. They were great. Maybe they did some good things in the 1600s, but forget them now.
Right,
I'm
more for the... You got to enjoy life.
That's right. I'm more for the Bacchus-type diet versus the Puritan-type diet.
I'm with you.
Limit the wine, but everything else, not in moderation. No, in moderation. This is public radio. We don't talk about in excess, except with knowledge. Looking at salt intake, but if it's reasonable, that's it. Those are the things to look at. Now, I recommend that you learn how to take your blood pressure, and I recommend that you do it with a cheap cuff that is not automatic. And the reason is they're actually very accurate. So you go to a store such as Target, and you look for the blood pressure cuff that has the stethoscope in it. Okay?
Oh, okay.
And you go to somebody who you know and you say, teach me how to take the blood pressure. There'll be a little explanation. The better ones come with a little CD that'll tell you what sound you're listening to. The first sound that appears is the systolic. The last, when the sound disappears, it's the diastolic. It's very simple once you learn how to do it, but you've got to be taught. And the reason is they're actually more accurate than the automatic
ones.
You
used to recommend against these
right. I recommend
things.
The automatic ones are not listening to sounds. They measure flow and they're not as accurate.
Uh-huh.
The ones you listen to, if you do it the right way, are accurate. Take your pressure. If it is consistently around 138, 139, 140 after you reduce your wine, then you have high blood pressure. You need treatment. We have dropped stroke by 65 to 70% and heart attacks by the same in the last 25 years because we aggressively treat high blood pressure. That's the vast majority. Cholesterol is number two. Blood pressure is number one. And treatment is, and this may be your body, that's the way it is.
Is there any age at which blood pressure doesn't matter anymore, say 95?
Never. It matters at all ages. And in fact, that was the old theory. The old theory was, well, when you get older, it really doesn't matter. You need more blood to get that blood to your brain. And the answer is no. High blood pressure, treated effectively throughout the lifespan, reduces the risk of heart attack. More importantly, stroke. This reduces stroke dramatically. Huh. So, no.
Well, we have some more research coming up, interesting research, our medical myth buster, and more of your calls, too, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413, is our telephone number. And before we get to the next call, Zorba, it is research time. And this sounds interesting to me for younger boomers, it says, who may need help with their hips.
Right. It is it's different from a total hip. These are for baby boomers who usually have arthritis or have previous injuries. And it's a technique that originated in Europe, which is really, it's a hip resurfacing technique. Now, in order to look at this, we have to look at what happens with a total hip replacement.
Yeah.
A total hip replacement is where we have a metal ball that's in the femur, which is the major bone in the leg, and then we have a plastic socket that is put in the pelvis, and they interdigitate together.
Sure.
And that's the typical thing that happens. But what happens when you do that is the top of the femur is cut off and this bone is put in. The socket is put in and the bone is then removed. So that is a total hip replacement.
Right.
This is totally different in that it is a bone-sparing technique. That is, instead of taking off the top of the femur, they only shave off the head of the femur and they put a little metal cap on the head of the femur. And then if you look at the socket in the pelvis, they put a little metal cap in the pelvis.
Hmm.
So you have metal, like a ball bearing, pushing on metal, rather than the other socket, which is either a ceramic socket or a metal socket, which pushes in a different manner.
A couple of questions. Why is this better?
Well, number one, if it's better, it has to have bone sparing property where you're not destroying as much bone. That can be better because you have more bone there that may be healthier for the body. So that part may be better. It may be a quicker recovery. Once again, these things remain to be seen. They're not commonly done in the U.S. They're just starting. And The problem with hip replacements is they often last for 10 to 15 years, and then you just need a second replacement. And when you have the second replacement, there are issues that have to do with the cement and the stability of the second replacement, because the second time you do it, you're dealing with bone. A lot of the bone has been destroyed, taken out because of the hip. And so the real issue is does this preserve enough bone so if you need a hip replacement 15 years down the line, will it be a better hip replacement?
Well, maybe because you haven't done the whole bone thing in the first place.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Now, this technique, a similar technique, not this one, was common about 10 or 15 years ago, and they failed. It didn't work at all. But this is a new technique using new metals, and it may be that this new technique using new metals works. Certainly, the European counterparts say that they work.
I think it'd be hard to get the adhesive that would hold the metal.
No, it's the way it's put in. The adhesive is one issue, but it's really the bone sparing technique. So I think this is on the horizon. There's only one company. Basically, two companies that are making it. There are a lot more that are coming on their clinical trials. If your doctor recommends it, it's something that you want to look at. But remember, buyer beware, it's a new technique that we're just testing.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, a listener joins now from Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, no, we're surely happy to. How can we help?
I have had a toenail fungus for about 5 years. I'd like to have your advice about effective home treatments as well as any medical treatments using prescription drugs.
5 years living with a toenail fungus. That's not an uncommon length of time. A lot of people live them 15 or 20 years. On your great toe, which toe is it on?
Several toes.
Several toes. Okay. Yes. Were you an athlete when you were younger?
No, I was not.
No. Did you work on a farm or in a factory where you dropped things on your toes?
No, but I did have a toe injury about 5 years ago, and the nail came off, and that's really when it started.
Right, and that is a common way that it started. I had an injury. I came back from a very interesting trip in Venezuela, came into my bathroom, and I was doing some things, and I was having some trouble with the shower door, and pulled the shower door, and I'm doing things, and all of a sudden, wham, it went on my toe. I'm sure I broke the toe. It did bother me for a couple of months. But exactly the straight line where it went on the nail, that's where my nail fungus started from that forward. Over-the-counter techniques, well, they tend not to work. And there are a lot of techniques. You go to the web and you'll find, 100 different techniques. Put on, dried wormwood oil, spray it with Listerine. Go onto a full moon and do prayers in order to get rid of the fungus. And believe me, none of them work. Now, the techniques that do work happen to be the medical techniques, but they're expensive, and some insurance covers it, and some insurance does not cover it. But quite often, if you want to have it covered, you have to go to your doctor, and you actually have to have a test to see if you really have the fungus. In other words, you have to have a scraping or a culture. The one that's advertised on TV all the time is called Lamisil, and that costs about between $700 and $1,000. For a course of therapy. So if your insurance doesn't cover it, it's expensive. There is something called Penlac, P-E-N-L-A-C. Penlac is basically a medicated nail brush that you put on that is just like putting on nail polish. And it's a polish that basically contains a substance in it. You do that for 6 or 12 weeks. That's also effective. Once again, approved by the FDA, expensive. I'm not sure what the cost is. I think it's less than the Lamisil. And then there are a couple of other drugs that are on the market, too, and there are different ways to use them. These drugs work about 80 to 85% of the time. They are effective, but they're new, which is why they're still under patent, which is why they're expensive. If you wait another 5 years, they'll go off of patent, and then they'll be cheap.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for the call. Do you still have yours, or did you get rid of it?
No, I still have mine, and I don't use nail polish.
Ooh,
on it. Thank you very much. Oh, it's not that bad looking. Here, I'll take off the shoe and show it to you.
No, thank you.
It's not that disgusting looking. Please.
Well, let's do our medical myth buster now. We have a cooking myth today. It has to do with leftovers. Should we let food cool before we refrigerate it to avoid bacteria?
No. Not at all. You know, that is a old myth. The old myth probably stemmed from the fact that we used to have ice boxes back, 75 years ago. Right. And if you put hot food in the ice box, it had ice in the freezer. Basically, the ice didn't last for 24 hours, so it was much harder. But the fact is, as soon as you've finished eating, the best thing you can do is put the food in the refrigerator, because bacteria multiply every 30 to 60 minutes. Bacteria multiply when food is warm and at room temperature. They multiply much, much less frequently in the refrigerator, which is why our food lasts longer in the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. You know, outside our food might last for a few hours or a day, and inside it can last for a week or two, because basically we're keeping the bacteria content down. So the answer is no, you should put it in the refrigerator quickly. If it's a large, soup bowl, the best thing to do is to divide it in two or three smaller containers, shove it in the refrigerator, but do not let it cool to room temperature. Oh. It's not bad for the refrigerator. It's not bad for you to put the food in and cool it right away.
Tend to make a great big pot of chili.
Yes, you do.
And then eat a couple or four bowls out of the pot.
That's right.
And then let the thing sit until it cools down some.
Yeah. Why? Because
we don't want to heat up all the food around it in the refrigerator. Uh-huh.
Well, you should put it in small containers and then put it in the refrigerator. You buy
but
those
we
those
reheat it again
containers. Yeah.
Till it's like boiling.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
they're
in other words, you don't take it out of the pot.
No.
You leave it in the pot.
No. And that's
that's why you have food poisoning once a week at your house.
We
that's
do
the
not
whole
have
problem.
Food poisoning.
I don't know. That's what I've heard from other people. You know, don't go to Tom's house and eat that chili. You go to Tom's house, eat that chili. You'll walk out. You have a little diarrhea and vomiting. I want to hear
what some of these other people. We haven't had any other people over to eat at our house in about 19 years.
That's the problem with people. But that's you, Tom, always looking for the exception to the rule. So how long does that pot of chili, you make it on Sunday, how long does it last?
Maybe the three or four meals.
Three or four
for
meals.
The two of us.
How big is that pot? You make a
it's
big,
a, it's you a make big a pot. Yeah,
big
yeah, we eat a lot. We eat
chili.
A lot of
you like chili.
Yes.
With beans?
Of course.
Hot?
Lots
hot
of beans.
Chili?
As hot as you can get.
Hot as you can get.
Yeah.
Hot fresh bread with it? You like some fresh
absolutely.
Bread with it? See, it's already a little salad on the side?
Yes, indeed. So, don't let that fresh myth you'd like Zorba to bust sit out. Send it in right away. Just send that email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our telephone number here is 800-462-7413. Just thought I'd let you know in case you'd like to talk with Zorba. 800-462-7413. And a listener now, Zorba in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Yes, perhaps we'll be talking about another myth or busting another myth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to know if what the doctor's thoughts are on people taking massive doses of vitamins over a period of years. And specifically, if it's possible for that to trigger a carcinogenic effect. Now, the reason I ask is that my father died at 78 of acute myeloid leukemia. It took him rather quickly. It's kind of a topic that the family talks about, is all these vitamins he took. He took handfuls of vitamins every day over a period of maybe 25 years, and I'm just... You know, we sit and wonder, my gosh, might that have altered his body chemistry in some way? So your thoughts on that?
Well, massive doses of vitamins had been studied over and over again to see if they prevent cancer, you know, to see whether or not large doses of vitamin C. Linus Pauling, who won the Nobel Prize for Peace and the Nobel Prize for Physics, was big on vitamin C, turned out to be proven scientifically not to be very useful at all. But because Linus Pauling had such a tremendous impact as a great person, for many years, people have and continue to take that, especially 20, 30 years ago, because he said vitamin C will prevent the common cold and cancer and other things, and the fact is there's no evidence of it. Now, there is evidence that a multivitamin is worthwhile, but on the other side, there's no evidence that massive doses of vitamins will cause cancer. There's no evidence in there at all. There's evidence that we don't need too much vitamin K. We don't need too much vitamin D. Vitamin D is usually in calcium when we need it. We need a certain amount, but the fat-soluble vitamins, which are A, D, K, and E, are the issue, although vitamin E doesn't appear to be toxic in large amounts. And the water-soluble vitamins, take them in, pee them out. Take them in, pee them out. Take them in, pee them out. That's basically what happens, and I don't think his vitamins caused his leukemia at all. We don't know what causes leukemia. He had a common form of leukemia that occurs in that common age group, and he died at 78?
Yes.
So I have a question for you. 78 young or 78 old?
78 young.
That's right.
It was a real shock to us because we voted him most likely to live to be 100. It was just a given.
He was that healthy. It was a given, and he was 78.
Right.
Now, if we look back in the 1950s, what did you think about they thought of 78, the age of 78?
Oh, in the 1950s, 78 was ancient.
78 was ancient. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think if somebody dies at 78, they've died young. I don't think of 78 as old. I think of 88 as old and the appropriate time of death. And I don't know in the next 20 years or so if we'll move that up to the mid-90s. That's a good question to me. But I agree with you. There are a lot of 78-year-olds who are extremely healthy and vibrant. He died of a common problem and a common disease. I don't think it was vitamin-related. I don't think there's any evidence that there is. And I think you should go back to the other members of your family and say, he died of this disease, which is really awful. We don't know what caused it, but vitamins, I don't think that's it. The vitamins might be that which kept him vibrant until he had his disease. Because usually people who take lots of vitamins have other things in their lifestyle that are positive that they engage in. So,
well, thanks for calling.
You're very welcome.
Good luck, and sorry for your loss.
Yeah, and all those of you young 88-year-olds, can address your emails to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Before we leave, Zorba, a quick question from Shailaja in Hartford, Wisconsin, who writes, I am traveling with our two young children to India. I hate public restrooms, and the kids touch everything. I was planning on carrying toilet seat covers until I read that they serve no purpose. What can I do to survive the planes and the airports?
So when she's talking about toilet seat covers, they serve no purpose. Well, they do serve a purpose. They serve a purpose in that someone who takes it may feel better sitting on a toilet seat cover versus the toilet seat. In other words, you know, they feel as if they have
Yeah, but it's totally mental, you're saying.
Well, that's all right. There's nothing wrong with
something. Yeah, but now she doesn't think they serve
kids.
A purpose. It wouldn't do her any good to use those because she would know that there's no medical.
In other words, she can't fool herself
with the toilet seat covers. So what else can
you do? Well, the other thing you do is you take a soapless cleanser and you wipe the seat before you use it. That's what you do. And you can definitely clean the seat. There's nothing wrong with that. And that's what some people do. They will take wipes. They're like baby wipes. They're quick wipes. And what they do is they wipe the toilet seat before they sit on there so that you can definitely clean the seat. And that serves a purpose. The covers tend to be fairly meaningless. There's no evidence that disease is spread on toilet seats. On the other hand, some of those public toilets are pretty disgusting. And especially you're traveling with your kids. You're going to India. You can imagine what there is. So what I would do is, A, I would have the covers there anyway in case you felt more comfortable. But B, I would definitely bring disposable wipes, and I would wipe the seat before I sat on it, and that gives you a level of comfort. And I would also bring soapless cleanser to wipe your hands before and afterwards, and that also gives you a level of comfort, I think, in cleanliness. And that is perfectly fine.
And good. We try to cover everything here on Zorba, Pastor on Your Health.
Keep those
questions, comments, and tips coming, Justin. Send them in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Zorba, thank you very much.
Stay well, Tom.
For a copy of this week's recipe and all things Zorba, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
And don't forget, you can call our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio, and our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Leftovers Kohlberg and Adam Friedrich are the guys on the other side of the glass. Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidrum. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark. Hoping you're with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For a copy of today's show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0210Z. To buy Zorba's book, The Longevity Code, your personal prescription for a longer, sweeter life, or to pick up a copy of Zorba's Heart Healthy Cookbook, just go to our website at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.